But I think it goes back to telling a good story, to making sure that there's enough balance and content. I think what you're doing right now is excellent, because what we're going to be doing is seeding a transcription algorithm for you and for I, so that we have some relevance the next time a crawler scrapes Spotify, is that there are keywords that begin to pop up and match when looking at Alex Carlson or Nick Hoffman. So that's exciting. Absolutely. Is that this reinterpretation of methods and medium. As the designer, we lived in this world of what used to be 640 by 480. That was a resolution for television and early monitors, and it became, you know, 720 by 1280. And we had this shifting of expanding colors, expanding resolution, and we felt really comfortable in this world for about 10 years. And then this notion of, no, it's mobile first.
Welcome to the AI Marketing Navigator, where we simplify AI marketing to keep you ahead of the curve. Brought to you by DigitalPop, delivering AI marketing automation so your small business thrives. Here's your host, Alex Carlson.
So still some area for growth, I think we can all see with AI. And if you're a front-end engineer who can really speak these languages just as well as Cursor can, and you can serve as a translator, I think your job is still safe for a while. So let's talk about another aspect of the work you do, a big part of it, and that's research and the challenges around these huge, huge data sets and getting into them, pulling information from them. Are there research tasks that you use AI for that you still feel AI AI is now taken off of your plate? And what are the prime uses for AI and research for you as it comes to when it comes to data from maybe a financial institution that is paramount for being accurate? Is AI up to par yet?
Yeah, I'll go back with some history of it. You and I are using a platform called Descript, whose killer feature a couple of years ago was the ability to auto transcribe these conversations, as well as sort of snip and edit at a very fine grain. I think that was, one of the things that AI took early on off of people's plates. It's funny that there's a San Mateo County, which is just across the bay and home to many of these companies that are creating these technologies. If you want to do work for the city, the county, you have to make a pledge that any AI tools you use will not replace jobs. Meaning, if you conduct events for the county, town halls and forums and feedbacks, and you have to put the transcripts up on the web, you can't use an auto transcription service or an auto translation service, because they have 5 official languages in the county of San Mateo. You need to have a human in the loop. And so in order to bid and win these kinds of contracts, you need to show that, yes, we're using these algorithms to help us with this workflow and to save you money, but we're also retraining these individuals so that they know how to correct the transcripts, how to upload them, how to manage that workflow now. And so now they're not just doing that repetitive task, they're upskilling themselves so that they understand where it's advanced to. Coming off of that story that I just told you, the unsung heroes are the designers that are still there, that are having to go through and maintain those patterns. And I thought, this is a Fortune 100 company. This is, from a financial services standpoint, a very highly regarded technology adapter, given their business model and given the newness of their organization. And if they're a couple steps behind, what must it be for the rest of corporate America? And so you go back to surveys, and I'll go into that in just a question. By the time these words hit your ear, fellow podcast listener, I will have a survey up around an industry assessment of where that maturity level for UX and design teams are, what kind of roadblocks are in place, where do you use AI in your corporate workflow now? And what I hope to do is be able to report back and cluster and segment different types of responses so we can start to discuss, where does that advisory need to be made? Is it in this tool here? Is it in a cultural sense? Is it in a maturity of data and integrations? And you can find that at retrain.com gauge, G-A-U-G-E, .io, and I'm sure Alex will have it in the notes. But that is helping that dialogue start about, hey, we are all very vulnerable here because product and engineering are all swimming in the same pool using the same tools, and they can create a design as easily as we can. How do we bring in our value? Referring back to your question about research, and I think that's the answer, is that we have an understanding of the process and the procedure to get these early iterations and these prototypes in front of our users. And in the case of that contract that I just mentioned, it was 12 users. It was a small three groups of people across different teams that were responsible for putting these deals together and in place. And if they messed up or if they broke, it was their job. It was that money. And to be able to conduct an assessment and to report back from a strategy perspective of these are the changes that need to be made because of the interruptions in workflow is where design and user experience research really still has value.
Of course. Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. I'm going to keep you on your toes here, jumping back and forth a little bit. I want to go back to your current teaching and your education. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you still teach at your alma mater, the California College of Arts. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the next generation of designers coming in. You've even worked with people that are brand new in the field. What are the skills that you're emphasizing to these students right now? Is it the same skills that were taught to kids in the internet age? Just embrace the technology. What are the lessons you're trying to impart? You mentioned rewriting the entire curriculum now over a year. What does that new curriculum look like for these students?
Yeah, I mean, it's using generative tools much more. I think that to be able to have that convenience of the last couple steps or maybe the last half of the design and development process has achieved this velocity that we had to anticipate, the ability to go from idea to interaction is extremely efficient these days. And the skills that we hope to teach through this curriculum is to make sure that idea is the right one. Many of you may be familiar with the British Design Council Double Diamond, where you start with a generative thought of like making sure that we're designing the right thing. You go and get this feedback through research, and then you sort of synthesize that down before you begin the design process. Well, if that back half of the timeline is now moving at such a speed, it puts importance on the front half to make sure that we're having enough strategic thought, that we're not making larger mistakes faster than we would have if we didn't go at such kind of pace. And so what does that mean? How to be a strategic thinker? If you are able to provide evidence-based research and strategy and understand market conditions, and again, we've got these wonderful research tools at our fingertips, I think that kind of approach, and these in the course that you're mentioning, these are mid-career professionals going back to school, probably because they're burnt out or they want to change jobs or they want to start a company or learn about AI. And that kind of reassessment is this natural mid-30s, mid-career take that a lot of people do. And I want to encourage that, but also be pragmatic with how you're coming about these decisions before you jump into prototypes and before you jump into product development. And that you mentioned it earlier about embrace the technology and ignore the tools, like the junior designer I mentioned earlier, where mm-hmm. if you took away those tools, how do you do what you still do? How are you still a designer, a researcher, a practitioner? Because we've just entered an era in which those tools turn upside down and the medium for which we're designing for is changing rapidly.
Gosh, you're speaking so much to what we talk about on the show so often, that now it's truly more about the ideas and the quality of concept that you're presenting or bringing to whatever project you're working on, because you now have the speed of AI, and it's either going to accelerate the bad or it's going to accelerate the good. And it really speaks to me a lot, as I've been a technical marketer throughout my whole marketing career, not classically trained in marketing philosophy or theory or anything like that, and have learned everything self-taught. And so now the job that I always had and did what was the publishing of the social media, building a website, doing paid media, all of that's going away. And it's now the quality of the story you are telling has never been more important, whether that's in the product or product design, the blog you're writing, whatever that is. So much that we talk about so often there in your answer. Let's talk about, let's look ahead into the future. Something I always like to ask our guests on the show, what are you most excited about in the next 2 to 3 years in the direction that you're seeing AI going and in the direction you're seeing the future of design going, the industry you're in? What's exciting you in the near future?
It's there's this muscle memory. You know, I know a lot of us and a lot of your listeners are internet natives where they grew up, you know, having it in the palm of their hands or on their laps. And these metaphors of mediums, of trends, of approaches are happening again as they did 20 to 25 years ago. And that's comforting and scary at the same time. Because there's a sense of regret of like, oh, I missed out, or I should have started this or done this back then when there was this platform war between mobile devices. That was maybe 15 years ago. And that there's this notion of we're entering in an era where it's happening again. And what I'm reading these days is how do I optimize my brand or my product for LLMs? Mm-hmm. And the rush of people to figure out how do we optimize our product or brand for SEO in the early 2000s, when it turned out it was a big thing and people used the internet instead of the yellow pages to look up companies. That was $1 billion. That gave us Google, because that's how they made their money, was through AdWords. And now we're having this sort of inflection of the way that we seek information is changing. It's just a pivot from a prompt cursor from a search bar, but still the method in which the results are being delivered is changing, and the rationale and algorithm for which it's making these decisions are kind of unknown. And we felt that way back in the early 2000s, where we weren't sure how to game the algorithm so that our results would come up to the top. You could rewrite the URL, you could seed, you could link, you could do all these things. And so that research is really right at the forefront or the cusp of how we position ourselves. And as a technical marketer, that's got to be right in your wheelhouse of how do you put that platform out there for your company. Because I've now started to hear whispers and rumors of, we just got our first client who said they found us on ChatGPT.
Absolutely.
How do we do that? And nobody knows. Like, it's kind of, there is a Harvard Business Review article that came out just a couple of weeks ago that has some early research on it. But I think it goes back to telling a good story, to making sure that there's enough balance and content. I think what you're doing right now is excellent, because what we're going to be doing is seeding a transcription algorithm for you and for I, so that we have some relevance the next time a crawler scrapes Spotify, is that there are keywords that begin to pop up and match when looking at Alex Carlson or Nick Coffin. So that's exciting. Absolutely. Is that this reinterpretation of methods and medium. As the designer, we lived in this world of what used to be 640 by 480. That was a resolution for television and early monitors. And it became, you know, 720 by 1280. And we had this shifting of expanding colors, expanding resolution. And we felt really comfortable in this world for about 10 years. And then this notion of, no, it's mobile first. It's not desktop first. You're designing for mobile, Luke Roblowski. And we had to rethink our patterns and our interfaces and our systems, because mobile was now going to be the de facto way people looked at your application, website, whatever brand, whatever it was. And I think that same kind of muscle memory is occurring again. It's like, you thought you got comfortable because you were doing this thing and technology just swept the rug out, and you've got to reexamine what it means to have a presence, have a marketing campaign, have content, and have an interface or not. And that's exciting to me.
excuse me. Oh, there's so much excitement as well. And your last kind of story about the shift in screens and the shift in the way that people were digesting the content. And I don't know that visual is going to be going anywhere too soon, but I'm sure you've heard too, and between the new partnership with Sam Altman and Joni Ive and what they're looking to do for product design, the next wave of devices might not have screens, might not even be a visual device. They're going to be always on audio. And like I said, I think wearables and something with a screen or something with a user interface, whether it's augmented or virtual reality, is still going to be very much a part of the future. But where is design's place in a world of a necklace that just is listening and can speak to you? And is it just product design at that point, or what is the future of design in a screen free world?
Yeah, I agree with your gut instinct of, you know, the visual will always have a place. But who are we designing for? Are we designing for agents now? When we look at the Rabbit, which was I don't know if it's flopped. Apology for the pun. But it was a beautifully designed device. Teenage Engineering made the hardware for it. Scandinavian audio manufacturer. And it's a beautiful. And one of the things that this pocket device, this AI assistant, would do was it had a platform that it would go and browse websites for you, so that if you could communicate to it, say, find me something on DoorDash to eat for dinner, it would understand the patterns on a DoorDash website and click those buttons and fulfill that transaction. And so we've got these agents that are now using websites and understanding pattern libraries of interaction to be able to fulfill requests. And so that's, you know, it's intimidating in some ways, mm-hmm. because you've taken out all the subjectivity of a design, and now you're just sort of wanting to make sure things are standard so that, again, a humanless interaction can take place from an efficiency standpoint. But where that notion of humanity comes in our work, in a screenless world, in a world that is increasingly algorithmic, whether it be the pattern libraries that we generate or whether it be the interactions that are occurring, is that how do you show that there is a human in the loop, that there is somebody that's watching out, that there's transparency of here's how we're doing this. I think those are some of the distinguishing factors that we can start to play into to maybe make things messy at certain points to show that it's not just all perfect. That's what I'm excited about, is how to keep bringing that humanistic element into a world that's efficient and algorithmic while still maintaining the integrity.
Sure.
Thanks for listening to the AI Marketing Navigator. Ready to simplify your own marketing automation? Digital Pop helps make it happen so your small business can scale your marketing fast. Learn more at thedigitalpop.com.